Excellent. Now Gary's here. The meeting can start.
That's right. Oh, thank you, Commissioner.
Wonderful. Well, good morning, everyone, and thanks for taking the time to be here today, both members of the working group and members of the public who are tuning in. I'm going to begin, of course, by calling the roll. Please answer when I call your name. Melina Stratos for Ruth Ann Biznoskis. John Rhodes.
Thank you.
Vincent Albanese. Omar Freya.
Good morning.
Thank you. Henry Garrido. Patrick Jackson.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning. Gary LaBarbera, I know you're here.
I'm here, Commissioner. Good morning.
Good morning. Michael Padgett.
Here, Commissioner.
Thank you. Brian Raley.
Good morning.
Good morning. Jim Shillitoe.
Good morning.
Good morning. Maritza Silva Farrell. Ted Skirpon.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning. Lara Skinner. Candace Tolliver. And Randy Wolken.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning. Well, thank you all for joining us. Today, we'll also be joined by panel members and agency staff supporting the Transportation Advisory Panel, including Executive Deputy Commissioner Ron Epstein, which we're very excited about. They're going to be a really big part of what we're doing here. We will ask them to do brief introductions during their relevant agenda item, but welcome to those colleagues as well. So here on the screen, you see today's agenda. It will be filled with lots of discussions, so I hope you have your coffee with you. We want your participation. We will debrief from our February 3rd public engagement session and reflect on some of the comments that we received, both during the public engagement session itself and in written comments that we have received since then. With those comments in mind, we will then further explore and discuss potential workforce strategies. We would love for this to be a fulsome discussion among the groups, so get your comments, questions, and feedback ready. This is where we really need your input, because you're the experts. At 10:15 a.m., as mentioned, we will be joined by several members of the Transportation Advisory Panel and supporting agency staff. This will be another great opportunity for cross-panel engagement. They are going to give us an overview of their strategies to help us engage in a discussion about what a just transition could and should look like in the transportation sector. Finally, we will conclude with updates from our subgroups and outline next steps, including a pair of quickly approaching meetings in March. I know February is a short month and we're almost through it. So as we've done before in prior meetings, we'd like to ask if there are any specific updates that working group members have and would like to speak to. And this is a reminder, this is an opportunity to share notable announcements, milestones reached, new initiatives or events, or other activities relevant to our Just Transitions Working Group. So does anybody have anyone that they'd like to highlight briefly at this time? We'll wait to see if anyone's hand goes up. Okay. Well, remember, we do this in every meeting, so make note of things that are happening if you want to share it with all of us in the future. Alrighty, so let's look at our public engagement session and recap. Let's dive into our first main agenda item. As you'll recall, on February 3rd, we held a public engagement meeting focused on the topic, understanding workforce training and development in the new clean energy economy. The meeting began with background information on New York's existing clean energy workforce landscape and was supplemented by presentations from four organizations working directly on clean energy workforce training and development across the state. And finally, the core purpose of the meeting was supported by a public comment session, which yielded insightful and thoughtful comments, questions, and perspective from a range of voices. I know the virtual public input session took some getting used to, but you know, after a year of Zooming, I think it's getting more natural. I'm glad we were able to make it work in the spirit of public engagement. So next slide, please. Now, early February public input session was just one element of one public and stakeholder input process, which you can see described further on this slide. As the slide suggests, we are just about caught up in getting meeting presentations and notes posted to the climate.ny.gov website. So make sure to check those out if you missed a meeting or need a reminder on the discussions. Next slide, please. So this next slide shows a summary of the key topics raised in the public engagement portion of the February 3rd meeting. As shown, the public engagement meeting revealed a number of critical issues and opportunities for the JTWG to be aware of. Of specific note, comments were raised relating to ensuring good wages, transparency of CLCPA implementation, providing support and workforce access to disadvantaged communities, and determining sources of funding to support the continued development and administration of targeted apprenticeship, workforce training and development, mentorship, and K through 12 STEM programs, all very important initiatives, and all working to address New Yorkers' needs and support the just transition to the clean energy economy. We have a slide teed up in a moment for deeper discussion and reflections, but are there any quick questions or comments on this recap slide? Anything, anybody jumps out at anyone? Okie dokie. All right, well, with that, I'm going to pass it to Doreen for the next slide.
Yes, good day. Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning, everyone. It's great to be here again with all of you. This next slide captures additional comments that were shared with the working group in written comments via email to the Just Transition Working Group. And as shown on the slide, the written comments focus further on specific issues, including environmental and racial justice and equity in workforce development, addressing a just transition from both the supply and demand side of the energy industry, including via contracting standards, expanding on local workforce hiring opportunities, exploring options for early retirement and pension planning, prioritizing support to individuals impacted within disadvantaged communities, including rural communities, and strengthening opportunities for cross-training and additional education and training pathways that support the just transition. So certainly a wide variety of comments that have been received, and we can certainly make all of these comments available via the SharePoint site for any members interested in reading the written feedback we received and is summarized here. Beyond that, though, we did want to recap this written feedback as well as the comments received in person on February 3rd to ensure that those important statements do not get lost and rather remain at the forefront of our collective considerations, including, as you'll hear in today's discussion on workforce issues. So there is a good amount of detail in these two slides, and we'd certainly like to pause to ask members of the Just Transition Working Group to take a deliberate moment of pause and reflection as we move on to the next slide for open discussion. Next slide, please. Thank you. So as you organize your thoughts and reflections on some of the input we have heard, I would like to open it up for members to reflect on this public engagement meeting and any of these summary public comments as well. So I will pause there. If you'd like to weigh in as to what you heard or impressions you had, please do just raise your hand in the webinar, and we'll be glad to call on you at any point. And if you need help figuring out how to do so, you just click the participants tab and the hand raise button is in the bottom right side of the screen. Not seeing hand raised. I think there's a couple topics that we certainly would want you to think about. I'll give you a minute, but I think, you know, in some instances, we'd be pretty interested to know if there were particular comments that surprised you, or in fact, if there were topics that were absent or not a focal point of the summary we just received. Also, just the types of stakeholders and individuals who provided comments. An interesting cross-section of interested observers and participants, so any thoughts you have. And then, of course, any responses you might provide to those comments as well. All of this would be quite interesting for all of us to hear from you on. And while I wait, I think it would be useful. Some may know that indeed we actually are going to need to say goodbye, well, farewell, hopefully it's not goodbye, to a member, a valued member of this Just Transition Working Group. Our colleague and friend, Chair Rhodes, John Rhodes, will be departing from the Public Service Commission later this week. Although John is certainly irreplaceable, we will be delegating a new member and a representative to carry on the work of the Just Transition Working Group as he departs. But given that this is his last week and indeed his last meeting, it'd be great if he would have any observations from this process and specifically from these comments to share. And of course, any parting thoughts for all of us as well. So Chair Rhodes, are you available to say a few words?
I am, thank you. Thank you for putting me on the spot, President Harris. Eric, it's just standard MO. Good to see you're not gonna change. More seriously, thank you for giving me a few minutes to talk. Yes, you have it right. My term is up in February, so I'm leaving really at the end of this week. Broadly, it's been a privilege to work on this clean energy agenda. I've been at it now for 7 years under the governor with all these colleagues, and we've gotten a lot of really great work done, all of it with partners. And that note of partnership is probably the one that looms largest to me as I think about the work here of this Just Transition Working Group and of the highly related work that's going on over in the Power Gen Advisory Panel, which for a few more days I'm also the chair of. And it goes to the point that the clean energy transition that we're advancing, engaged in, is also clean energy jobs transition. Everything is better when you plan ahead and are mindful. Plan beats no plan. And particularly with respect to the workforces that are currently in at work, employed in facilities that whose future is uncertain, it's critical to do our best job of planning for the workers, as I said, but also for the communities. This planning requires good information about the affected workforce, about their skills, about their interests, about their willingness to do this or that or the other. We will certainly need smart transition services for the workers, accounting for pay levels and benefits and other worker protections. All of that will be better and more workable the longer the runway, the more awareness, advanced awareness of any transition. So quite clearly, this is a team effort. It does require partnership. with the facilities, with the workforces, with the advocates, with the various agencies and NGOs that can provide some of the necessary services. We just need to do all of this right. I sound like, and I don't want to say, and I think all of the points I'm making are really important. I also think they're all absolutely right. And I say this with no whatever. I'm not bragging about my insights. I just think that this is what we are hearing loud and clear from you and from the public when they give us the input. And to me, these observations are right on the money, and it's very, and we'd be very well advised to be very mindful of these, to plan well for the transition, to get the necessary information, to organize the smart services, and to do it collectively with partners. I think that's the right track. So those are my thoughts. I doubt they're very surprising, but I think they're important.
Well, thank you, and I think it is true. You know, the points are well taken, and I'm imagining that members of the working group would share many of your views. I do see a few hands raised. So let me start to see what we have from Randy Wolkin in the first instance. Randy, see your hand is up.
First of all, I would echo your comments that they were well said in terms of partnerships and planning. And thank you for your efforts, John. I also wanted to comment on the working group public session. I was glad to see the focus on building pathways to future work through apprenticeships and other ways of preparation. We found those to be so critical in the manufacturing sector and throughout the sectors that we work. So I'm glad the public has communicated that same desire, much like John said, about overall planning. We need to do it in the workforce space. So I just wanted to comment on that and say I have heard that time and time again from companies and individuals who are looking for work. And so if we build strong pathways, I believe there'll be pathways to energy jobs.
Thank you. And I see Omar also has his hand raised.
Yes, good morning. Thank you.
Good morning, Omar.
Yes, so I was just reflecting on recalling within the comments that were made, one or a few that actually stressed a reframing, I thought, of what we typically think of with the transition, and that there was at least one person who had mentioned not prioritizing not to the exclusion of others, but not just focusing on those who are in the existing industries that are to be cleaned up, that are in the dirtier industries, to not let that be the stopping point, and to not to prioritize that over others. And I heard in that, also in line with what we had been hearing in terms of the demographics of the industries and being disproportionately white in terms of the greener industries, when we look at alternative or more renewable sources of energy and the potential there, and existing industries, energy industry. And that I'm seeing that part of the transition is also just a transition toward away from a segregated workforce, a transition away from opportunities that all don't have access to. And so creating creating pathways for the startup MWBE entrepreneurs, for people who want to get into the industry coming from communities of color to be able to get there. And the focus on workforce development is critical, but it was also I thought I also heard in comments was that it's not merely a question of removing creating the training programs, but that there are people who, you know, they're in the industry and they're facing bias within hiring practices based on race and based on gender, and that those are things that still need to be addressed when we talk about creating a just transition. So it's partly, creating the pathways for training so that people can get into the industry, but there are also barriers that need to be removed for people that are in the industry already. So those are, you know, some of the things that jumped out at me, in addition to the piece about, you know, really emphasizing that we're seeing this as an opportunity to create opportunities, seeing this as a moment to create opportunities for people that haven't been in the industry, as opposed to just seeing it as, or primarily seeing it since this as a moment to create a pathway for people who have jobs in the industry, who are, you know, seeing a wall coming and are looking to move towards something greener and cleaner.
Thank you, Omar. That's really, really important context for all of us to have. I see James Shillito also. James?
Good morning. I just wanted to thank Chairman Rhodes for his great comments. I fully support all of the comments that he made, and I know we need to focus on minority, disadvantaged communities and all that, do need to be a part of this, not to make a hierarchy, but I do feel strongly that the people that are in the current industry need to be considered in many different aspects of how we're going to get them transitioned. Whether they're going to transition to retirement or they're going to transition to the new type of energy workforce that we need. Not the sole focus, but I think it needs to be the primary focus, because they are the ones that are providing the power now and will continue to provide the power until we're able to transition over. And again, I fully support everything that Chairman Rhodes just said, as well as the other speakers. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And thank you all, those who raised their hands to weigh in. I see another hand, my co-chair, Commissioner Reardon. You don't need to raise your hand, but I'd love you to weigh in on any of these topics.
It's always fun to get to raise my hand. First of all, thank you for the members. Very thoughtful contributions. And, you know, I think it is going to be a difficult task sometimes to balance everybody's concerns, to be very candid. But that said, we are balancing everybody's concerns, and we can't disadvantage one group over another. That's actually why we're here. So I thank you all for your candor and your input. But most of all, I want to say thank you to John Rhodes, who it's just been an incredible pleasure to work alongside of you. You know, I've been Commissioner of Labor now 5 years, and you have been a constant colleague and so thoughtful and so welcoming when I first came into the cabinet. And I really value your participation and your thoughtfulness. And I know you're not going to go far. You can leave the chair, but you can't leave the group. And I look forward to seeing you around this group, because you're an important part of this conversation and you've done such great work for the state. So please don't be a stranger, because we still need your voice. And but do take some time off if that's possible, because you've certainly earned it. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for those nice remarks. It feels good. It feels especially good to see this team with this momentum. So I won't go far, but I will be. I'll be cheering for the work and accomplishments here. So thank you all.
Yes, thank you, and thank you everyone for the robust discussion and for your kind remarks of our Chair Rhodes. For those looking for additional opportunities, I'm sure they will present themselves as the week forges on, concluding with our Climate Action Council meeting scheduled for Friday. So certainly there is more discussion that will take place going forward, but we would all agree that this input has been particularly useful for us at this point in time. So for now, let's move on to our next agenda item. If we turn to the next slide, please. The next portion of today's meeting will delve into some of the workforce training and development considerations for initiatives and ideas discussed by this working group, as well as other working groups, including some overlap with the public comments we have heard. Of course, these workforce considerations will be further informed by additional stakeholder input and feedback, as well as the work underway, such as the job study that we've previously discussed, as well as assessments of job opportunities and skill gaps specific to certain industries and sectors. For example, the offshore wind resource as a good point of reference. So as we go through this next section and hear from our colleagues, your feedback is particularly welcome so we can ensure the initiatives that we are describing address the concerns and feedback as comprehensively as possible. So with that, I'd like to hand things over to Adele Ferrante from NYSERDA, who will walk us through the next sequence of slides focused on workforce training and development. Adele?
Thank you, President Harris. And Chairman Rhodes, good luck and best wishes. I really enjoyed working with you over the years. The following slides are intended to capture the illustrative strategies, preliminary recommendations, priority areas, and feedback received to date from this working group, the stakeholder input session, input from the advisory panels such as energy efficiency and housing, energy intensive industries, power generation and transportation. As you all know, these initiatives will be further informed by the work being conducted by BW Research in the job study and groups such as the Workforce Development Institute that are assessing workforce needs and skills gaps in partnership with offshore wind training entities such as Orsted and Suffolk Community College. That's just one example. Next slide, we're gonna first take a look at some of the demand side workforce initiatives. And let's make sure we all have a good understanding of the term demand side. We are really looking at strategies and considerations related to the drivers of job creation and workforce needs. So as we'll see, this can include policies and processes undertaken by contracting or procurement entities whose investments are supporting job creation and hiring, where there's an opportunity to influence workforce outcomes by harnessing the demand their activities are creating. And these demand side considerations are really designed to support business needs. The business needs are the drivers, the needs related to workers and the needed skills for those workers. So again, these are the illustrative examples and highlights that we've pulled out of input to date. And the first category or topic area is hiring policies in terms of conditions for employment. We've heard a lot of good input about standard wages, providing health care, pension benefits, provisions for local hiring, provisions for targeted hiring as we think about those priority populations and disadvantaged communities, and getting to Omar's point about, you know, reframing and giving opportunities for folks who have been left behind in the transition to a clean energy economy, but also certainly focusing on apprenticeship training, pre-apprenticeship programs, again, addressing business needs through these activities. some of the comments really focused on what the requirements should be for larger projects. You know, again, still to be defined what a large project is and the scope of those projects. Having project labor agreements that drive the work being done through some of these projects, as we've seen in some of the renewable, large-scale renewable energy projects. Smaller projects, again, we need to figure out what that means, what the size of those projects are, but supporting those employers through community workforce partnerships, target incentives for targeted hiring, employee training incentives, and other benefits to make sure that those workers are certainly provided good opportunities through these smaller projects as well. We're also looking at targeted business and financial support, focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion, working with MWBEs and the unique challenges that they face in this area, especially as we think about the scope of projects and providing scopes of work that can really be amenable to smaller companies in some cases. Certainly continuing our support, as I know the Department of Labor has also worked closely with service-disabled veteran-owned businesses and even cooperatives, you know, companies that are owned and managed by employees, and we think cooperatives are also a good part of the mix here. And then finally, on the demand side here, stimulating project demand, making sure we have adequate funding allocated to advance the goals of the CLCPA, looking at different funding sources and opportunities, promoting manufacturing of clean energy components and equipment locally versus overseas. What are the training needs that we have to support the supply chain as we think about all these clean energy components and the various supply chains we'll be working with? And then again, as we all know, focusing on creating stable, well-paid jobs. So as the commissioner mentioned earlier, it's a big task at hand with a lot of components to balance, but we're up to the challenge and we've gotten some great feedback to date. Next slide, please. So thinking about the supply side, and again, for this term, we mean considerations related to maintaining and boosting the supply of workers and future workers. Thinking about the skills that'll be needed, thinking about the skills gaps, how can we think about, as we heard earlier, that career pathway, those channels to clean energy jobs that start in K-12 schools. For these slides, we've kind of provided some labels here to help us think about things that are longer term versus short term. And we don't mean to say that some of the things that are tagged long term can't start now, but we see those taking a longer time to really impact the workforce and the skills we're thinking about enhancing as we move through different career pathway tracks. So K-12, as I mentioned, has come up many times. We have had some experience with K-12 programs in the past, working with the School Power Naturally program, partnering with NYPA. We see the technical P-TECH opportunity as something we should look at further, opportunities to expand that. And of course, working with community colleges and four-year universities, as we think about engineering programs, as we think about architecture programs, as we think of other degree and certificate programs. Following along those lines, we also, of course, have to think about pre-apprenticeships as we think about working with younger workers, internships, things that would lead to an apprenticeship program. As you may recall, the governor announced in the State of the State, NYSERDA will be developing a new Climate Justice Job Corps fellowship program that we hope to kick off within a few months, where we're going to provide excellent opportunities for fellows to work for 12 months at a family-sustaining wage with benefits in jobs that will really introduce them to climate justice opportunities and careers. We also see a need for technical training, career awareness, and supportive services. Again, this category is for new workers, and we'll talk about existing workers in a moment. But we're thinking about, as we prepare new workers, what are those training areas that we need to focus on? And then, of course, career advancement and management leadership training. We don't really just want to place folks in a job and wish them well. We want to support them through their career development, giving them opportunities to advance within a career. Next slide, please. So again, we're still focusing on new workers and some of the things we need to do to support them. And some of the funding support related to training and work experience include on-the-job training programs, where we're providing them with a pathway to get up to full productivity quicker through mentorship and on-the-job training support. Perhaps employer grants for New York State registered apprenticeship programs help employers develop new apprenticeship programs or modify apprenticeship programs to address clean energy considerations. Some of the leadership in workforce development needs we see are, you know, continuing our stakeholder engagement to better assess and continuously assess demand and needs. Again, I guess something we're going to be doing in the near term. We certainly have been doing this for years, but we need to do a lot more of it and think through some of the balancing considerations we heard about earlier for priority populations, existing workers, supply and demand needs. Facilitating communications and forums to share needs and best practices, another good consideration we've heard from numerous people about. Supporting opportunity awareness and recruitment, trying to basically making sure we're providing more information about careers, opportunities to recruit folks from different populations, especially as we think about priority populations. So those are some of the considerations we've heard about to date. And again, we're learning more as we go. We expect this list to be a little bit better defined over time. And then now we'll shift to existing workers. Again, we're thinking about both the supply of new and existing workers. And we've heard from many about the need for continuing education for existing workers, upgrading their skills, training them on new technologies, new technology types, thinking about potentially training existing workers more on energy efficiency, best practices, opportunities in the energy efficiency retrofit area, for example, building electrification as we focus more on heat pumps and application for heat pumps, and healthy homes and healthy buildings, another area where we see an opportunity to cross-train and provide people with additional training in new areas to expand their capabilities. Working with unions to incorporate renewable energy and decarbonization training into existing apprenticeships. We've talked about some of this before, how we've worked with unions to expand their training programs as they align themselves with emerging technologies. We see this as an important opportunity. And of course, across the board, as we think about existing workers, and as was mentioned earlier, we're looking at fair pay considerations, making sure these new jobs pay as well as the old jobs and what we need to do to support that. Next slide, please. Thinking about just transition considerations, a label here we've used to specifically refer to workers who may be transitioning from or within traditional energy sectors. These are some of the resources and programs to provide support for fossil fuel workers that we've heard about so far. Understanding and leveraging transferable skills with complementary training, both in terms of energy and non-energy roles. We need to really learn more about what those worker plans are for retirement, interest in retraining opportunities, and interest in really moving on to new careers in the clean energy sector. As we think about direct displaced worker support, we've seen and heard from groups looking at training funds, dedicated training funds, wage supports. Certainly the Department of Labor has had some great experience with job fairs and strike force support, where they work in areas of high unemployment. They work with employers and the folks looking for work and training providers to really address very specific needs. We really have heard a lot about doing more work to identify distinct strategy and responses for key existing traditional energy sectors, such as power generation, transmission, distribution and storage, fuels, and motor vehicles, transportation. We also are looking at opportunities and needs to target efforts specific to both technologies and regions, right? We really need to match the technology needs with the regional needs, with the employment situation in a region, the workers in a region, and the skills gaps that we need to address to better position them to get new jobs in these sectors. Again, we think it's really important to begin training while the fossil fuel workers are still working, right? Better position them for the transition once that transition happens. What can we do to retain workers through the end of a facility's useful life? And again, prepare them through training in the near term to better position them for clean energy jobs. And then we're also, you know, looking at opportunities to leverage decarbonization related roles and employers where appropriate, where it aligns with business needs. I've seen some job posting recently for climate analysts, environmental analysts at firms where they probably never had that position before. So again, new opportunities, and how can we help position people for those new opportunities? Next slide, please. And then just some general considerations that really apply across the gamut here. And as we think about some of the things we need to do to really support all of our activities, whether it's new workers, existing workers, we need to really have more outreach related to training opportunities. We need additional case studies, kind of showing some of the successful models. Career awareness is critical, especially as we think about working with the K through 12 schools and colleges and universities. As we think about our audiences, and this gets to Omar's point earlier, how can we both balance, you know, our goals for workers that are transitioning from traditional industry and priority populations that we're trying to engage in this sector? And again, it's a question of skills, it's a question of technology, it's a question of region. So we're looking at all of those considerations. And frontline communities, communities that are, you know, most impacted by some of these transitions, and how can we be in a good position to serve those frontline communities? We've got other considerations like online versus in-person training due to COVID. We've always thought that a lot of the workforce, especially new workers, is going to be really driven by hands-on training that really is needed to prepare these workers for some of these jobs in many cases. But due to COVID, we've had to rethink some of those things. Hopefully that's temporary. And some training providers have done a really good job in figuring out social distancing for hands-on training. And again, as we think about effective workforce development efforts, we need to always focus on diversity, equity, inclusion, and inclusion. We're looking at opportunities to provide training in different languages. We've done a little bit of this. We need to do a lot more for sure. Wraparound services are critical, especially as we think about workers with additional barriers to employment. We've seen needs related to transportation, proper clothing in the construction industry, for example, supplemental training. Some folks have issues with childcare services, so we need to look at all those wraparound services needs. And again, flexible course scheduling. If we're thinking about people that are currently working, we need to have flexible scheduling so they can take courses at night or on weekends. So we're always keeping an eye out for opportunities to really maximize access to training. And safety training is always critical, whether it's OSHA or EPA certifications related to refrigerants. How can we really prepare these workers with not only the technical training and the wraparound services, but the safety training they need to do really well in this economy? So I know we've been through a lot of slides here and a lot of different considerations. Love to get your comments.
Adele, checking here. Adele, do you have access to the hands that are raised? Just looking, there are a few members. If you'd like the commissioner or I to play MC with questions and discussion, happy to do so. Otherwise, feel free to just take a look at the participants list.
Yes, I see the question from Michael McGlynn. Is that correct? Or do we have other hand raising feature? I guess I cannot see that.
Okay, no, that's fine. I think in order, I see Maritza, Omar, and Patrick, if you want to start there, Adele. So maybe start with Maritza.
Okay, Maritza. Thank you, Dory.
Yes, good morning, everyone. And thank you, Adele, for such a great presentation. Really appreciate the thoughtfulness around thinking about workforce development opportunities in the context of what, you know, the kind of jobs that we want to create. So I really appreciate the analysis there. I do want to raise a couple of concerns that I have in terms of how do we move the implementation of CLCPA in a way that really does not undermine the opportunities, particularly in a time where we're seeing the need for, as you mentioned, energy efficiency to happen. There is like such opportunity to create jobs in that sector. Air quality, HVAC systems are going to be critical for us to be able to go back to our offices, to our jobs, in terms of the context of COVID. And I wanted to raise a concern here in this space in relation to a budget line that it's being discussed right now at the state level that could potentially undermine the creation of jobs in this particular energy efficiency area. There is in tier the just to make aware folks who might not be aware, there's a part R of the TED bill that essentially is making it so that the local law 97 won't be able to be fully implemented because it is allowing now to expand the market of renewable energy credits to large buildings. The local 97 in New York City was said to create specifically jobs in the energy efficiency sector, and tier two recs that the buildings will be able to access that particular pool. There are already existing sources of renewable energy that will be used, so there is not going to be a creation of new energy. And so by effectively incentivizing new investments, these waste resources needed to meet, they won't be able to meet the CLCP renewable energy targets. So I am a little concerned about in terms of the market for the job creation when at the same time we are losing opportunity by allowing for this kind of efforts to happen in the budget at this particular moment. So I want to make us all aware that we could be creating jobs in the energy efficiency sector. The workforce development is key, but also we have to create the market. Without the market, the jobs, folks are not going to be able to get the jobs. So I want to raise that concern here and maybe for us to think about how do we ensure that those things don't happen moving forward.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great point, Maritza, and you know, happy to speak at any point on the topics you're bringing up. Indeed, this is one of the really, I would say, nuanced and important aspects of our work, in that we are all driving toward, you know, we are part of a broader movement here, right? New York is certainly integrated not only with the broader federal policy at this point, but also, to your point, you know, with the specific objectives of Local Law 97 and New York City's policy as well. So it is the case that it is going to be a world where we all need to determine, you know, the best ways that we can work together in many respects in this climate. Yeah, it was specifically with respect to the changes you're referencing for Part R. It was an objective to align the law with the changes to the Clean Energy Standard that were implemented last year in October, specifically in support of the clean energy goals. And for those who are aware, it's providing a temporary approach for the procurement of RECs to offset emissions limits in those buildings. But we certainly share and would strongly agree that we in New York remain committed not only to bringing additional renewable power to New York City, but also, to your point, to continue those very important investments in the buildings, in efficiency, and of course the jobs that those investments will create. So so it's a great example, and I'm glad you're actively engaging in that dialogue, Maritza. Adele, I think next up I saw Omar's hand, and then Patrick.
Thank you. So I had a thought just related to the presentation, but I'll just say, just to Moritz's point, I'm not familiar with the details of what was discussed, but I am always concerned about just making sure that we pay attention to the mechanisms that finance the transitions that we're looking for, and making sure that there's always incentives for moving towards that transition. So I'd like to learn a little more about that. What I do want to say related to the presentation is it was great. I love the range of proposals. The range of proposals. I especially, of course, love to seeing cooperatives on the list. One thing that jumped out at me is with respect to creating the opportunities for people who have not been part of these industries, particularly people of color and women in the industry, is the importance of what was brought up early in the slides, which was opportunities for businesses, for the MWD businesses, for social disadvantaged businesses in particular, in that while I would say that the having the workforce training is critical, at the same time something else that I believe needs to be recognized is that there is social segregation, and there's segregation within the U.S. in terms of hiring. The greatest bang for the buck, I believe, is going to be when you have businesses. There's an increase in the percentage of businesses that are owned by people of color and by women, and that we'll see greater inclusion of workers from our communities, from these communities, when you have the owners of businesses, of those businesses that are coming from those communities, just for the simple fact of people are hiring from among the people that they know. Whether there's there doesn't have to be an intentional bias there, but just people are hiring from their social circles, from the communities that they're a part of. And so really putting a greater emphasis on creating the opportunities for business ownership within these communities themselves. That was all.
Yeah, that's a great comment, Omar. We really have been thinking about opportunities to support business growth and new businesses into this area, new UDEs. So that is a great point. And we agree that is really a good way for us to diversify workers within those companies as we support those businesses. Next, I think we had Gary.
Yeah, I'll wait. Hi, it's Pat Jackson with Corning. I guess I Adele, thank you. Nice presentation. It's nice to see it coming together. A couple of comments I was wondering about is the clean fuel segment. The businesses that are represented here. I think everybody's trying to tackle our scope 2 emissions. I think that NYSERDA has helped us over the years to develop programs to go after scope 2 reductions. I think the one area that I'd love to see more action on is on the scope 1 emissions. In the business impact subgroup, we spent some time talking about the opportunities maybe to work with the COEs and the CATs to develop, clean fuel alternatives, green hydrogen being one of those. I believe that presents a huge opportunity for jobs. Other countries have done this really well, created these rings. Within 100 miles, you can go with manufacturers that are looking for high heat to go to these areas. So I think it would become a magnet for New York State if we concentrated and had an answer for scope 1.
thank you. Just to clarify, the adult COEs and CATs, they develop training and serve an audience within 100-mile radius. Is that the suggestion here?
Well, I think it's something like that, yes. I think we could, you know, kind of define their role, how they could help us develop alternatives to, you know, dirty fuels. We could come up with a clean fuel environment. You know, many of the CATs and the COEs kind of touch on it, but I don't know if anybody's charged with developing green hydrogen as an example. I think Stony Brook, I think the COE, I think there's some work being done at Alfred State.
Great, thank you. I think we had Gary with his hand up.
Yes, hi. Good morning, everyone. So, yeah, I'd like to make two comments, one about the apprenticeship funding, and the other, I just want to respond to my friend Maritz's comments about Local 197. And I would like to maybe illuminate all of you on the call regarding the governor's proposal about the purchase of RECs and the thought process behind that. So as you know, as the president of the building trades, certainly in New York City, I'm closely work with the development community in New York City, building owners. And I just want to talk a little bit about the issue of Local Law 197. While very well intentioned, first I can tell you is that the way the law is written is that it is to transfer to use renewable energy sources to upgrade these buildings. That's the thought process to create the job opportunities, of which those renewable energy sources do not exist today. So on Class A buildings, for example, anything that's been built within the last 5 years, these are platinum LEED buildings, and there is no newer technology in the renewable sector that can be utilized. So the only result is for those building owners to pay penalties. And the other piece of this is you have B and C class buildings where the penalties may actually be cheaper than investing in those buildings because the buildings do not have the value. So I think what the governor's intention was there was the idea of purchasing RECs. That money would go into the market. And Doreen can expand on that. RECs are a very complicated area that I'm fully trying to understand. And we've had so many conversations regarding RECs and with our, you know, with Carol O'Rourke Pennington, Maritza, who you know well, our counsel. I know Doreen has been very gracious in her time with trying to understand RECs as it relates to prevailing wage and other issues. But my understanding is money goes back into the market, and these RECs are purchased, which will ultimately support the renewable marketplace. So I just wanted to illuminate that the intention of the bill is very noble, but I am not certain, given the conversations that I've had with numerous building owners, that the result of Local Law 97 is actually going to result in the job creation that everyone thinks is going to result, because there isn't these renewable energy sources available. And on top of that, as I said, there isn't much that buildings that have been built within the last 5 years can do at this point. There's nothing available. So, I mean, putting money back into the renewable market, I think, makes sense rather than just paying penalties. And Doreen, maybe you can illuminate that for us a little bit. And then the other comment I just had is I saw one line regarding the apprenticeship funding, and it said employer apprenticeship programs, grants for employer apprenticeship programs. I would assume that those grants would be available for jointly administered apprenticeship programs as well. And that maybe Roberta Reardon could answer that question. Those are the two issues I would like to talk about, which I have. And maybe, Doreen, you could explain the RECs briefly again for all of us on the call, because I think if I'm correct, the RECs put money back into the market, right? That's what RECs are. And those are used for the market. And then, Roberta, if you would just clarify for me, that grants are available beyond just employer, because there are employer-sponsored apprenticeship programs. They are also available to jointly administered apprenticeship programs. So thank you.
Yes, thank you. A very complex topic indeed. And I think, you know, indeed the governor's proposal has brought forth, in my mind, a very healthy dialogue around, you know, these, I would say, cross-cutting issues for sure, as it relates not only to Local 97, but sort of the balance of issues in buildings as it, again, relating to not only their emissions as well as their sources of power, specifically, you know, for their own use on site, sort of on site combustion, as well as through the electric grid as well. So it is a complicated topic, you know, fundamentally though, and directly to answer your question around RECs. You know, RECs are a renewable energy certificate. It's an instrument reflecting the environmental attributes of generation, renewable generation. And NYSERDA procures these RECs through long-term contracts for various generators. And the costs of those RECs are paid for by suppliers of electricity and ultimately ratepayers, consumers of electricity. So to the extent that a provision like the one proposed is advanced for Local Law 97, to the extent there are voluntary purchases made by building owners of any type of REC for their compliance, it would reduce the cost. It would go to the generators of electricity, renewable electricity, and it would reduce the cost of the consumers in other aspects of the state.
So it does go back into the market, essentially.
Yes, it does. Definitely. It does.
Right, rather than just paying a penalty. Right.
Thank you. No, it's going to the generators and reducing costs for others. That's how the instrument would function in that instance. Again, whether depending, you know, on the types of RECs that are ultimately eligible, which is the question at play. Local Law 97 already included eligibility for RECs generated or delivered to New York City. The question is really whether additional types of RECs are eligible as well. So I hope that's helpful. And I would say on the apprenticeship question, I'll certainly ask Commissioner Reardon and or her team to weigh in.
Thank you, Doreen.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think the answer is yes, but I'm getting more clarification for you, Gary, but I do think it applies to jointly administered apprenticeship programs as well.
Okay.
I'll clarify, I'll find out if there's
sure. Questions.
Yeah, but thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Thank you both.
Sure. Do we have any other people on this section, or should we?
I don't see any new hands unless someone with a hand up from an earlier question has an additional question.
Okay. So let's move on to our next section. And now we're going to be joined by four members of the Climate Action Council's Transportation Advisory Panel. They are Kendra Hems of the Trucking Association of New York, Karine Talo, I think that's Talo, of We Act for Environmental Justice, LG Holstein of the Environmental Defense Fund, and Paul Allen of MJ Bradley and Associates. So welcome. Thanks for joining us this morning. The transportation members and staff will give our Just Transition Working Group members a brief overview of strategies under consideration by their panel. We will then collectively engage in a discussion around the potential impacts of these strategies on workers, communities, and businesses, and how we ensure that elements of a just transition are represented in the panel's recommendation approaches. So with that, I will pass my virtual mic to Adam Reuter, who is NYSERDA's Assistant Director for Clean Transportation, to get us started. Adam.
Thank you, Commissioner. And thank you to the entire Just Transition Working Group for having us. If you can move to the next slide, please. So by way of a quick introduction, the Transportation Advisory Panel has been working hard on developing recommendations, as have the other panels. And we have been developing strategies and recommendations in four main areas, one being electrification and cleaner fuels, where we're focusing on how we can get to 100% zero emission vehicle purchases, and how, and by about 2035 or 2045, depending on the vehicle type, and how we can support policies that increase the adoption and use of cleaner renewable fuels in the meantime, for vehicles that haven't yet switched over to zero emissions. For public transportation, we've been identifying ways that we can expand availability, accessibility, reliability, and affordability of public transportation, especially in underserved communities, and looking for ways to potentially double the use of public transportation over the time period. For smart growth, which is really about aligning development and new development and transportation options, we're looking at ways that we can put policies in place to direct development into areas that are better served by more transportation options and public transportation, and also expand those options, those transportation options, to new places where they haven't been available. And then on financing and market-based programs, we're really looking for opportunities to support the types of policies discussed in the previous three realms and fund those types of policies. So this is a really brief overview of the work that we've been doing. And I'm going to turn it over to Kendra to lead a discussion of how we can be part of the discussion around just transition and across the transportation sector.
Great. Thanks, Adam. And we can actually go to the next slide. Can we move to the next slide? There we go. So thank you for allowing us to be part of your meeting today. We had a meeting last week with the Transportation Advisory Panel, and really a great discussion. I felt very productive related to the workforce needs that are going to result from this transition from carbon internal combustion engines to zero emission vehicles. So we have a series of questions. Actually, we need to go back one slide. I'm sorry, we went or too far. There we go. Okay. So a series of questions that came out of this discussion, and obviously some points here that we spoke to, and certainly and as needed. We were hoping to do was engage in a discussion with the members of the Just Transition Working Group related to these workforce development initiatives. I can speak specifically from the trucking industry. We have a workforce shortage of qualified drivers and technicians today, and I believe this transition to zero emission vehicle is going to pose a series of some challenges, but also some opportunities to maybe introduce the industry to some potential individuals that may not have considered trucking previously, but now that it's becoming more technical, there's going to be a higher skilled workforce that is needed, that we may have some opportunities to actually attract some of the younger generation to this industry. So, certainly some challenges to overcome as far as training and preparing the workforce for this transition, but I think some opportunities as well as maybe attracting some new individuals to the transportation industry. In addition, really tying into a lot of the discussion that's already been had this morning, There's some opportunities for lower income or underprivileged communities to get into this industry with some of these transitions. Already within our industry, our association is working on some programs with Department of Labor related to unemployed individuals, veterans groups, as well as very preliminary talking about incarcerated individuals and opportunities for employment when released. And some of that training for those individuals can occur while they're still incarcerated so that they have that basis when they come out of the system. So I think a lot of these the same work that we're doing today will translate well as we're starting to prep folks for this next, rendition as we move into a zero emission vehicle. So with that, I'll kind of move into the questions. As we said, workforce opportunities that will be created by the green transportation system, some of the items that were discussed during our call, ownership opportunities, as well as the technology that will require workers with computer technology and software abilities. And this is, again, going to be a transition. It's been occurring already within the trucking industry, but certainly will be accelerated as we move towards zero emission vehicles. So I can open it up from here. I don't think we need to read through each of these specific questions. You can see them on the screen, but I guess start with this slide and just open it up for discussion. Or additional questions that the group may have related to the conversation the Transportation Advisory Panel previously held. So no, Green, LG, or Paul, if you want to jump in and maybe add a little more flavor to this to get the discussion going, or we can keep moving through, or Adam as well, since you were part of that conversation.
And I appreciate the slides that were shared earlier. I think we're, without having met before this, we're kind of all thinking about what these gaps that are need to be filled, particularly around the more technical education that needs to happen in worker training. And I wanted to identify my colleague, Charles Calloway, who's on. He is WEAC's director of organizing, and he also runs our worker training program. And I don't know if Charles, if you wanted to share anything, but in general, our perspective has always been like, how do we provide that training to get people skilled up? But then how do we ensure they actually can get the job placements? We've had, you know, our track record in terms of training is really great, but then the transition to employment can sometimes be rocky. Charles, if you wanted to speak to that, that would be great. But I appreciate at least that holistically we are thinking about, you know, the questions we have are some of the same questions that it looks like the broader worker just transition group is having too. I don't know if Charles is on mute, but I know he was listening. Okay, I'll keep going. But yeah, I think the challenge, and I believe someone also made the comment too, that people typically hire who they know. And so how do we kind of break out of those, the social constructs and the relationship impacts that come to job creation? But I think these questions are pretty thorough.
So I have a question. It's Commissioner Reardon. I'm sorry, but connecting trained workers to jobs, I know we at the Department of Labor have a jobs bank, and so we do that work pretty regularly. Are you saying that the barrier that you're identifying is that this is a community that's not known to the hiring entity, or is there some other barrier that they're facing?
Oh, hello. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you, Charles. Thank you.
Yeah, so my name is Charles Calloway. I've been running the worker training program at WEAC for the last 4 to 5 years. And we actually did a great job in training folks in the solar industry. We realized that as we continue to send people out on job interviews and so forth, so on, that we were not getting any return on our trainees, right? We work with Solar One. And, you know, we were really, we worked with some other companies, such as, you know, some private companies, and they were hiring one or two people. The history goes, we decided that the only way to give jobs is that we had to create our own company. So we ended up going to the Omar's group, Omar, what's your name of your group? I apologize. Green Cooperative.
Green Workers Cooperative.
Green Workers Cooperative. And we were there for about 6 months to 7 months. We did all the training that it was. We ended up training 10 guys. And they stood together. And then we started, like, subbing out as a unit, as a green workforce unit. And we ended up actually working with a guy in Croton who just did a 4 megawatt system, and he hired the whole team. So, you know, understanding how this works, it was better for us to actually create our own entity and then go out and supply a workforce for a company. Individually, it hasn't happened. Sitting one person is just, it hasn't really been a good journey for our workees. Just understanding that the doors are not as open as we would like to think. And especially in the solar industry, we found out. And our solution was that we would just create our own business and go out and, you know, be a component to solve a problem around the workforce and solar.
Charles, can you also speak to just our OSHA card, our OSHA training? And I know we've trained over 2,000 people in that area. And what has been the experience of the folks who've gotten that training?
All right. So we've had a little bit better success in that because when we started the OSHA training after Superstorm Sandy, we knew there were going to be many jobs in the area of construction because we had to rebuild. And a lot of people had the skills. By having the skills, we just didn't have our folks in our community didn't have the money to obtain the 10-hour OSHA that was required. So we ended up getting some funding from an entity, and we ended up training people in 30-hour OSHA, and we've had a fairly good turnaround. A lot of people have gotten jobs. A lot of people have gone out there on their own, but they already had the skills and they already had the connections to a certain degree, but they didn't have the money to obtain the OSHA card. So we provided that training. We also train people in BPI. We also train people in asbestos removal, which we also teamed up with Local 79, where we have people out there doing asbestos removal. So there is, you know, a good amount of training out there that we do as an organization, but sometimes those doors are not as open as we would think they are. We have to figure out ways in which we can actually be a part of the economy. So that's what I'll finish at.
Thanks, Charles. And I think just kind of walking through this a little bit more, you know, when we look at the introduction of zero emission vehicles into the market, one of the challenges we have is you can bring them to market, but who is equipped to drive those vehicles? Who is equipped to maintain those vehicles? And are we preparing our workforce for that? Right now, as I said, most of our diesel technician training is occurring. There are some BOCES programs across the state that provide it. There are some technical schools specifically that provide it, but it is very much focused on diesel engines. There's not a lot of work currently being done related to electrical engines and the software and technology that's going to be required to maintain and repair or diagnose any issues within those engines. And I think one of the points that came up in an earlier conversation today was, it's not about just training those individuals, but who is going to train those individuals? And are we preparing the instructors with that information? I did come across in California a partnership, and I think this is where we're likely going to have to look as we start trying to pull this type of training into curriculums is a partnership between Volvo and a essentially what would equate to a community college here in New York. But Volvo is working directly with that school to assist in the training on their new, because Volvo does have electric vehicles, so heavy duty, medium and heavy duty vehicles in the market. So I believe that's likely where we're going to have to go, but it's how do we get there? How do we start to develop those partnerships? And then one of the other key areas that we discussed on our call is that oftentimes the students that we see come into these fields are those individuals that maybe did not have an interest in technical fields or going into a college environment. And so they were looking at OCs and going into more of a trades career. And those trades are very quickly becoming much more technical, and you have to be computer savvy. So that is also going to create some challenges on how do we prepare those individuals for this, for the workforce that we need. So I don't know if that helps in terms of starting some discussion on these, or if there's any thoughts or questions, we'd certainly be able or be happy to address them.
Kendra, thank you.
Yes, Paul.
This is Paul Allen from MJ Bradley and Associates. I think that part of what is emerging in the transportation advisory panel is a sort of a sense of the timeline and the complexity that this transition is going to take. So it's a one way to think about it is this is a generation long evolution of the transportation system, and its convergence with a couple of other complicated economic sectors, primarily the electric grid, but not exclusively the electric grid, since there's highly likely to be very important ongoing use of liquid fuels of some sort. They need to be decarbonized, but we're not probably likely to have 100% electric vehicles, but a very, very big percentage of electric vehicles. It'll take 20 years. But in that period of time, Kendra's right, the complexity of the skill sets needed for skilled trades jobs is going to change, and we need to anticipate now that this has implications for STEM education and early childhood education, and so it's not just, I mean, yes, we need partnerships with community colleges and vocational training centers and the like, but we also need to recognize that the world is going to be digitized in a great many respects, and we need to prepare our young people for that starting now. And I mentioned on our call last week that there's an interesting model that the New York Power Authority has been pioneering to do STEM education in environmental justice vicinities, and it's small scale now, but it has shown real promise and has been embraced very enthusiastically where it's been done. And so I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that we can anticipate today that you know the future might not seem that different 2 or 3 years from now, but 20 years from now it's going to be tremendously different, and it needs to be to protect the climate and to take advantage of the better performance of these new technologies. But we have to be prepared to educate the people who will need to step into those careers 20 years from now.
It's Commissioner Reardon again. Can I just ask a question? Because this is something we deal with at the agency in other areas. So what you're really talking about I mean, we're all talking about is transitioning workers from a fossil fuel economy to a green economy writ large. What you're talking about in transportation is that transition is going to be, to your example, perhaps 20 years long to fully get to the other side. But in that transition, you're going to have workers who can potentially work on both kinds of systems as we grow the next generation of workers who will have rudimentary knowledge about fossil fuel and massive amounts of knowledge about the new green energy. And I think that's the transitional. You are correct that in getting young people in school to understand that's the trajectory they're aiming at, but also helping the workers and you know, for the labor side, for the organized labor side, the apprenticeship programs, how do they help educate their current workers or even their incoming workers to make that bridge? Because it's not just a straight shot, and it will be an unequal, it's not going to happen at the same velocity in every part of the industry or in every region. And I think that's the real complicating factor, is you're going to have some workers who are skilled. They've got two shoes and two canoes. They can do fossil, but they can also work on the new green stuff. And how do we make that transition? How do the people who supply the workforce participate in that?
That's very well said. And it also has very important implications for how it all gets paid for, because there are going to be circumstances in which, yes, private capital will be able to finance a great deal of it, but I would hazard a guess that it won't be able to finance all of it. And there are, you know, some of this is about very important public goods. There is a public interest here in protecting the climate, and there's a public interest here in making sure that the workforce is treated fairly, and that we address you know, past failings that have created you know, massive disparities in inequities. But we can do those things, but we just have to recognize that they're all part of the same ball of wax.
Kendra?
Yes.
This is
LG.
Hi, I'm LG Holstein with Environmental Defense Fund and a member as well of the Transportation Advisory Panel. I'd like to respond briefly, Commissioner, to your remarks of a moment ago, but then I'd like to address something I think we need to spend more time looking at, which is the demand side of the education and training equation. With respect to the way we think about and plan for the skill set in an evolution of our economy over a 20 plus year period, as Paul was describing, I find myself remembering the repeated urgings of Bill Clinton, who constantly says, and has been saying since the beginning of his presidency, that what we need to assume and plan for is lifelong learning. So even if you take one aspect of the clean energy transition and think about the widespread assumption that we're going to go to a largely a battery-driven transition of electrification of transportation, yet we don't know whether clean hydrogen could suddenly come on, and especially for trucking end up being a whole different set of skills that are required. So thinking about, you know, continuous and lifelong approaches to training instead of trying to guess now every skill set that will be needed, train people for those things and then pray that the economy will move in their direction. That will not work. It doesn't work for anybody on this call. So I think we need to keep that need for agility in mind. What I mean by the demand side is really to address some of the comments that Omar in particular was making in talking about the frustrations that I can imagine that trainees feel and you know, and people like Corrine and Charles and Omar feel who are trying to prepare these workers, when people are trained and then the companies or governments or whomever don't hire them for a whole slew of reasons, or say that that's fine, but I'm looking for something different. And addressing the demand side through the various mechanisms that are going to be available is one way to overcome this. And by demand side, I'm talking about the fact that the clean energy and transportation transition is going to require lots of government subsidies because the cost of this transition is high and the technologies are rapidly evolving. It's going to require grants. It's going to require loans. It's going to require permitting. Think of the new offshore wind that we're all excited about. And each one of those government programs or government tools presents an opportunity for conditioning the grants, the loans, the permits, the development of the offshore wind plant, et cetera, on an agreement by the sponsors of those programs and the recipients of that aid to incorporate training programs themselves, and also to collaborate with organizations like Corrine and Charles's. So I think that, and Omar's. And so I think there needs to be a continuous thought process about how we attach conditions to these government programs at the front end in the design phase, and not be thinking about them only later on when Omar comes back and says, well, we trained people to be wind turbine mechanics, but it turned out that the companies didn't hire them, or the companies were bringing in people from Texas or something like that, instead of training a homegrown workforce. So that's the demand side. And I think if we pay attention to that at the front end of designing these transition programs, energy, clean energy transition programs, we'll have a lot more success.
LJ, I think that's a great point. And, one of the things that we're doing currently that, hopefully as this transition occurs and the demand for those trained individuals is going to increase, but we're trying to build pipelines. So we're working with a variety of educational institutions across the state, and then within our own membership, identifying what are the employment needs within our membership. And then if we can find, members that need drivers or members that need technicians or, dispatchers, whatever the case may be, we work with those institutions to assist in the training of those individuals and then try and build that pipeline so they come right out of school and then go to that particular employer who will continue to train them once they're employed. So whether it's through an apprentice program or just continuing education. And I think that is what we're going to have to look at as this transition moves forward. To your point, identify what the need is, what are the employment needs, and then work with the educational institutions or training programs out there to make sure that we're meeting those needs and not training for things that are not needed. Because it, as you said, and I think Paul pointed out, we can focus on electric, but that's not going to be the immediate need within the next, 5 years. So are we looking more at ensuring with blended fuels, what are the impact on engines, and are technicians trained to address those? The fueling stations, there's specific needs for, natural gas fueling versus diesel fueling. And that ties in with, I think, our third question on here about challenges created by a green transportation system. And we certainly don't want to displace workers, but the first bullet here, we will see that. And so what are the opportunities that are going to provide it to those businesses that, whether it's service stations or gas stations, how do they transition to ensure that they are not losing their businesses as it related to this movement towards electric. So those are focuses that we need to be looking at here over the next 10 to 20 years as this transition does occur. And are we planning for these things and making sure there's opportunities that are being provided to those individuals that will potentially be displaced?
To LG's point about the continuing education piece, how can that be offered in a way that isn't like, it doesn't feel burden, like a burden to those that are already employed? And I'm only assuming because I don't know, but typically after someone begins the trade or work that they're doing, are there already those kinds of things in place, or is it you just learn your skill and as you go, you improve and you typically are good for the rest of your life? So if that's the case, how do we make the case and make it not like too cost or, you know, prohibitive for folks to participate in continuing education to get, you know, introduced to what the you know, how the fuels might impact, like that transition? How do we do that? And is it offering these kinds of classes for free? Is it offering some of them online? Like how do we do that continuing education piece to make it, you know, incentivize participation versus making it a burden for people who might already be economically impacted by other things?
Mm-hmm. I can speak quickly to that, and then we can move into this next slide we have. But within, at least within the trucking industry, I can answer the question, Corinne. There's a variety of different continuing education opportunities for those that are already in the industry, and specifically as it relates to technicians. They will oftentimes do additional training that's provided by specific vendors, for example. So whether it's fuelers or tires or you know, engine components or refrigeration components, oftentimes the vendors and or manufacturers of those components of the engine will come in and do specific training. So as technology changes, they can come in and train those technicians, and frequently the companies provide it for free to their tech, because for the company, it's an investment. They want to ensure that their technicians have the most up-to-date information and are qualified to repair these engines as they're changing. And so I do see that is something that would continue and would be part of this transition, that for those technicians that are already in the industry, as these changes occur, that training will occur. So they will get it on the job. But where we have to look, to Paul's point, is how do we start bringing the youth kind of into this world that we're moving into? And even though it may be 20, 25 years down the road, we do need to start thinking about that today. So I think with that, I know we're running short on the time we have for the Transportation Advisory Panel. If we want to move into the last slide, and I think we've talked a little bit about these points already, but to the point I think I just mentioned and Paul had mentioned, it's as we're making this transition, what are the tools that we need to providing, or how do we as a state and or country, really, because it's not just New York that's making these transitions, but how do we change our education system to ensure that we are providing the additional math and science that's going to be needed to work on whether it's trucks or turbines or whatever the case may be, or the specific industry related to moving towards the green economy. And I think the last bullet, I know there's some comments in the chat box here that somewhat relate to this last bullet here, about ensuring that as we are trying to make that shift, we want to get people out of their cars, but we still need to ensure that individuals can get to their jobs. So what are we doing to improve transit and creating those links to ensure that they have that opportunity to still commute without necessarily having to rely on driving cars, and addressing those concerns as well?
Thank you, Kendra. I'll note we have a couple of hands raised. I don't know. I would imagine they're intentional. Maritza or Randy, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I do. Actually, this is Randy Wilkin. I wanted to comment on one of the, actually, a very good conversation, by the way. I wanted to actually make a couple comments about the conversation. It really started with, you know, LG's comments about demand-driven. You know, in our experience working with manufacturers, with a lot in the tech field, the constant change and skill set needed to be successful, and I think educate the green economy transition, because one of the bullets you had is skilled trade jobs will become increasingly technical, requiring workers with higher education. And I'd like to focus in on that one, because I believe that all jobs are becoming tech jobs. There are very few entry-level jobs that stay entry-level jobs. They continue to require ongoing learning, which is one of the reasons why pathways, apprenticeships, and other forms of pathway, both creation and education, are necessary. I know this was brought up by several of the other panels. Like, what do you do if you're in the industry? If you can't afford to stop working to go back to school, you need the ability to continue to learn while you're on the job, because you need both the income and the opportunity. So I think we need to acknowledge that, generally speaking, much of the learning will take place in the workplace as you're working. We do need to create better pathways for new workers to get those skills. I couldn't agree more with any of the panelists who said we need to break down barriers. And quite frankly, we'll have to do that sooner than later. But if skills trade jobs are accelerating, and I believe they are, then if we work from the demand side and identify what's needed today, you'll continue to know the most recent and latest technology that has to be implemented. That's why we're big supporters of registered apprenticeship programs, because essentially it's learn and earn. And you start by being employed, and then you begin to learn, you continue to learn for a significant amount of hours. So what we've learned in our experience working with tech companies is that stackable credentials and ongoing apprenticeship pathways are the key to upgrading skills for the long term, which helps both employer and employees. We also been working for 2 decades now with schools to help on greater career awareness, because we know the student of the future may have 5 to 7 careers, not just one. So the reality is you have to continue to have career awareness even when you're employed, because you might be switching either employers and or careers. So I would encourage you to think about not higher education, though higher education is a part of the learning skill set. It really often falls on the employers in finding, as LG and others have said, a way to encourage, incentivize, and promote employer continuous investment is absolutely critical. And that way, by the way, we'll also be able to break down the barriers to entry. Because in the future, we won't be able to hire workers who've already had that experience, which is typically what a resume does. We'll have to hire people and then give them the experience. And I think that's what a lot of companies have now learned, is that you have to hire quality individuals and then give them the experiences they need if you're going to have the workforce. I'll give you just an example. During the pandemic, you would think with millions unemployed, it'd be easier to hire people. I'll tell you, my companies in the manufacturing sector are finding it harder. And that's where it's counterintuitive, but it has, again, to go with skill set. So they're literally hiring individuals from the sectors which are now not employed, for example, retail or hospitality, and then training them into the work over oftentimes a multi-year process. So I just wanted to offer those comments to reinforce what others have said, and to say I think this is a long-term effort, but if you start on the demand side and work your way back to education, you'll end up with, I think, some really well thought out pathways and current pathways.
Thank you, Randy. I know that was pretty useful for me to hear as well. I was interested, Adele, if you're still listening in actively, you know, this is an issue that we at NYSERDA have grappled with for a long time across multiple sectors. And really, when you look at what Randy's describing, it's how to ensure that these folks entering the workforce have the necessary skills. And I know when you look at gaps analyses, it would usually allow us to put programs in these areas, again, to get the workers ready for that workforce in the first instance. Is there anything you'd want to add in that respect in this context from our transportation advisory panel members?
Yeah, and I thank you, President Harris. And I think it also relates to some earlier comments. As we've been supporting workforce training in the clean energy sector over the last few years at NYSERDA, all the training programs that we support, whether it's career pathways or advancing the skills of existing workers, they're all driven by business needs. If we're going to train someone on a career pathway, there has to be a business at the end of it, or several businesses interviewing, informing the curriculum, providing job site visits. And you're absolutely right. We're basically in the career pathway world, providing them with the foundational skills, while at the same time, they could take advantage of our on-the-job training program to then hire them and to continue training, typically for 4, 6, 9 months. So completely agree with everything that's been said here. I think it's critical that we do tie business needs, business demand to training for new workers, as well as we think about what training we need to advance the skills of existing workers. And just to the earlier point, we have provided free training, low-cost training, webinars, after hours, weekends, whatever it takes to really support that worker looking to advance their skills.
Well, I think we've got some new connections here with our with the representatives here from the Transportation Advisory Panel. I know I learned a lot from this discussion. You know, our this has certainly expanded the thinking of the Just Transition Working Group. I can say that on behalf of the members today. So I'm very appreciative of the time that you took to sort of brief us on where you are in your thinking and the reality of your day-to-day work lives as well. I know we need to move on. Any last thoughts from the panel members, or can we proceed with our thanks?
Just thanks again for allowing us the opportunity. I do think there's a connection between the work that the transition group is doing and the discussion that the advisory panel has been having, and we're looking forward to continuing to participate.
Yes. Definitely. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. We appreciate it very much. So as we wrap up the meeting, we had wanted to provide an update regarding our two subgroups, first from Kara Allen and second from Jamie Dickerson. So, Kara?
Thank you, President Harris. And I want to start by expressing continued thanks to those of you who are on the Business Impact subgroup, as well as our partnership with the Energy Intensive and Trade Exposed Industries. As folks will recall, this really is kind of a hybridized subgroup focused on issues that impact both our working group as well as EITE advisory panel. So we've continued to meet and have been focused on our task of looking into the issues and opportunities for energy intensive and trade exposed industries as part of our transition toward a clean energy economy. In that context, and related to one of our other tasks, the subgroup has also discussed business and emissions leakage and efforts undertaken by other jurisdictions to minimize leakage potential. We've also discussed supporting those industries, taking early action to reduce emissions and trying to encourage more industries to be able to do the same. The subgroup has also identified the value of low-cost power programs, including those of NYPA, in providing a clean source of electricity that can help keep industrial greenhouse gas footprints low. The subgroup has also discussed the value of early planning and partnerships in identifying and harnessing economic development opportunities associated with the clean energy economy. Research on identifying energy-intensive, emissions-intensive, and trade-exposed industries remains ongoing and will help to support an understanding of related trades and skills of those workers, which is also another one of the Just Transition Working Group's tasks. And we are very much looking forward to sharing more with the Just Transition Working Group in upcoming meetings. And again, my continued thanks to those of you who have been part of our dialogues. They've been, I think, very enriching for all of us. And we're really looking forward to sharing more with the full working group very soon. And that concludes my update, President Harris. I think I will pass the baton over to my colleague, Jamie Dickerson, now.
Excellent. Thanks, Kara, and good morning to everyone. Similar, want to start with a word of thanks to Jim Shillitoe and Ted Skirpon for their contributions to the power plant working group subgroup thus far, along with Chair Rhodes, who I think had to depart this meeting, but whose wisdom will certainly be missed in our efforts. But thankfully, similar to business impacts, our power plant reuse inventory and reuse subgroup has been continuing to meet. We had the latest productive session just last week, in fact, and as we've heard over the last couple of months, our efforts remain really laser focused on the two deliverables that we're tasked with, which hopefully you're familiar with by now. But as a reminder, again, those are the tasks of inventorying power plants that may be closed as a result of a transition to a clean energy sector, and then in parallel to identify issues and opportunities presented by power plant site reuse. You'll recall specifically our full working group discussion in early December on those topics if you want to go back and take a look at those slides. So we've made good progress collecting data to fill out the various data categories that will be a part of the power plant inventory. We've been using those data collection efforts really to drive the development of our efforts surrounding the inventory. And similar to business impacts, we are aiming to discuss that inventory with the working group in some preliminary or draft form at next month's meetings. We've also been spending some time really refining and honing our recommended messaging to accompany the inventory, given the obvious, you know, sort of sensitive nature of the topic. So I want to be sure that we're communicating crystal clearly. And then regarding the list of issues and opportunities, we're also making good progress on this front and working towards building out a set of slides to summarize these issues and opportunities in greater depth, building on what we had previously discussed in December. So we're also looking forward to walking through these more detailed top issue summaries at our upcoming meetings in March. And it will indeed be great to get the full working group's feedback as we continue to refine our thinking. So, yeah, as Kara said, we're looking forward to sharing more with the working group at our upcoming meetings. And I'll stop here to pause for any questions or to hand things back over. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie, and thank you, Kara, and to everyone contributing to the subgroups. Just pause for a second here as we do just have an extra couple minutes if anyone, any of the members had questions for either Jamie or Kara. Crystal clear. Thank you both for the updates and for everyone for your continued work. If we pivot to the next slide, always want to end with what's next. Indeed, it is a busy week this week. As I had noted earlier, we have a Climate Action Council meeting this coming Friday, beginning at 3:00. The primary focus of the meeting will be on the topic of electrification, which is a central consideration across a number of the council's advisory panels, and I think integrated within our work, certainly as discussed today with members of the Transportation Advisory Panel as well. So a full agenda for the meeting may be found on the Climate Act website, and we encourage members, as always, to attend that meeting as your schedule will allow. Looking ahead, next month promises to be equally active, specifically for our Just Transition Working Group. Our group will meet again next week on March 3rd, and then again 3 weeks later on March 23rd, as we look to wrap up certain products for consideration by the Climate Action Council. So certainly know we are all very busy and that our members certainly are working not only on the working group in addition to the professional and personal obligations you have. So we rest assured this pace is really with an eye toward the Climate Action Council schedule and staying on task in that respect. But we certainly appreciate your help in dedication and commitment to this work. We are making incredibly good progress together, and we do look forward to engaging with you again soon, including at our next few meetings. So many thanks to all of you in advance for your participation. So with that, I believe we are ready to close the meeting. Commissioner Reardon, any thoughts from you, or should we say goodbye for now?
I just want to thank everybody for their participation. It's really valuable, and I know we have a tough schedule for these meetings, but I really appreciate your input because we can't do it without you. So thank you very much.
thank you. We will certainly be seeing you next week, if not before. Have a great week.